മൊഡ്യൂൾ 3 ജെൻഡർ ക്ലെയിമിംഗ് ആൻഡ് എഡ്യൂക്കേഷൻ എഡ്രീനി റിച്ച് ഇൻട്രൊഡക്ഷൻ. എഡ്രീനി റിച്ച്, ദ റിനോവ്ഡ് പോയറ്റ്, എസേയിസ്റ്റ് ആൻഡ് പൊളിറ്റിക്കൽ ആക്ടിവിസ്റ്റ് ഫോർ വുമൻ, ഹു ഫേമസ്ലി ഡിഫൈൻഡ് ഹേഴ്സെൽഫ് ആസ് എ വുമൻ, ലെസ്ബിയൻ ആൻഡ് ഫെമിനിസ്റ്റ്, വാസ് ബോൺ ഇൻ ബാൾട്ടിമോർ, ദ യു എസ് എ ഇൻ 1929. In the final year of her graduation, she won the prestigious Yale Series of Younger Poets Award for her book, A Change of World, in 1951 from a jury headed by W. H. Auden. She married Alfred H. Conard, a Harvard economist, in 1953 and became a mother of three sons by 1959. Her second collection of poetry, entitled The Diamond Cutters, was published in 1955. In the tumultuous 1960s, she became a great champion of the oppressed by standing for the rights of women and the sexual minorities. Besides her participation in the civil rights movement and anti-Vietnam War protests, her works Snapshots of a Daughter in Law in 1963 and Leaflets in 1969 were testimonies of her politics. Identifying herself as a lesbian, she left her husband in 1970, which led him to shoot and kill himself. Rich won the 1974 National Book Award for Diving into the Wreck in 1973, one of her most celebrated collections consisting of angry exploratory poems. She began co-living with the Jamaican-born novelist Michelle Cliff in 1976. The questioning of patriarchal assumptions, the need for change and the power of the will were the themes in her early writings until the publication of The Dream of a Common Language in 1978, which argues for a common woman's language, a concern of most feminists all over the globe in the 1970s. An Atlas of the Early World, 1991, The School Among the Ruins, 2004, and Tonight No Poetry Will Serve, 2010, are the titles of some of her poetry collections. Due to her differences with the policies of the US government and President Clinton, she refused to accept the prestigious National Medal for the Arts in 1997. She died on 27 March 2012 at the age of 82. In the 1970s, when Rich emerged as a radical feminist, she famously stated that the way we live in a patriarchal society is dangerous for humanity. She was unapologetic of her political stance and when criticized for anti-male bias in her writings. I make no claim to be universal, neuter, or androgynous. Her political belief is best manifested in her comment, "All human life on the planet is born of woman. The one unifying, incontrovertible experience shared by all women and men is that months-long period we spend unfolding inside a woman's body." Though Rich was famous primarily as a poet, she published 5 volumes of prose as well. Her prose is generally estimated as confrontational, treating women's role in society in various capacities. Through her writing, she continually challenged cultural perceptions of the self, of gender, and of sexuality, as well as her own beliefs and assumptions. In her polemical essays like Compulsory Heterosexuality and Lesbian Existence, she demonstrated how women's choice of women as passionate comrades, life partners, lovers, and community has been crushed, invalidated, and forced into hiding. Her demand for a more expansive view of women's sexuality and increased lesbian visibility, while seeking to undermine the notion of female heterosexuality as normal, required, and obligatory, made her a champion of the feminists and the LGBTIQ activists. Rich's Claiming an Education, the convocation speech delivered in September 1977 to the graduating women students of Douglas College, New Jersey, USA, speaks of the importance of claiming versus receiving an education, a dilemma faced in most schools and curriculums across the world. As many others believe, Rich explains that being educated is a right and therefore both women and men should claim that right. Receiving, on the other hand, is to accept as if education is being offered as an option rather than a right. Further in her speech, she goes on to tell about the importance of educating women as well as women's right in an educational environment. Rich considers the gender nature and the institutionalized biases of the academia and demands an education that requires an element of active personal initiative. She furthers her argument by stating that education entails being responsible to oneself, not just for women, but for all students. The speech titled Claiming an Education was first printed in the magazine The Common Woman in 1977 and eventually reprinted in the collection On Lies, Secrets and Silence. Selected prose 1966 to 1978. Text. For this convocation, I planned to separate my remarks into two parts. Some thoughts about you, the women students here, and some thoughts about us who teach in a women's college. But ultimately, those two parts are indivisible. If university education means anything beyond the processing of human beings into expected roles through credit hours, tests and grades, it implies an ethical and intellectual contract between teacher and student. This contract must remain intuitive, dynamic, unwritten, but we must turn to it again and again if learning is to be reclaimed from the depersonalizing and cheapening pressures of the present-day academic scene. The first thing I want to say to you who are students is that you cannot afford to think of being here to receive an education. You will do much better to think of being here to claim one. One of the dictionary definitions of the verb to claim is to take as the rightful honor, to assert in the face of possible contradiction, to receive is to come into possession of, to act as receptacle or container for, to accept as authoritative or true. The difference is that between acting and being acted upon, and for woman it can literally mean the difference between life and death. One of the devastating weaknesses of university learning, of the store of knowledge and opinion that has been handed down through academic training, has been its almost total erasure of women's experience and thought from the curriculum and its exclusion of women as members of the academic community. Today, with the increasing numbers of women students in nearly every batch of higher learning, we still see very few women in the upper levels of faculty and administration in most institutions. Douglas College itself is a women's college in a university administered overwhelmingly by men, who in turn as answerable to the state legislature, again composed predominantly of men. But the most significant fact for you is that what you learn here, the very texts you read, the lectures you hear, the way your studies are divided into categories and fragmented one from the other, all this reflects, to a very large degree, neither objective reality nor an accurate picture of the past nor a group of rigorously tested observations about human behavior. What you can learn here is how men have perceived and organized their experience, their history, their ideas of social relationships, good and evil, sickness and health, etc. When you read or hear about great issues, major texts, the mainstream of Western thought, you are hearing about what men, above all white men, in their male subjectivity, have decided is important. Black and other minority peoples have for some time recognized that their racial and ethnic experience was not accounted for in the studies broadly labeled human, and that even the sciences can be racist. For many reasons, it has been more difficult for women to comprehend our exclusion and to realize that even the sciences can be sexist. For one thing, it is only within the last 100 years that higher education has gradingly been opened up to women at all, even to white middle-class women. And many of us have found ourselves poring eagerly over books with titles like The Descent of Man, Man and His Symbols, Irrational Man, The Phenomenon of Man, The Future of Man, Man and the Machine, From Man to Man, May Man Prevail, Man, Science and Society, or One Dimensional Man, books pretending to describe a human reality that does not include over one half the human species. Less than a decade ago, with the rebirth of a feminist movement in this country, women students and teachers in a number of universities began to demand and set up women's studies courses to claim a woman-directed education. And despite the inevitable accusations of unscholarly group therapy, fadism, etc., despite backlash and budget cuts, women's studies are still growing, offering to more and more women a new intellectual grasp on their lives, new understanding of our history, a fresh vision of the human experience, and also a critical basis for evaluating what they hear and read in other courses and in the society at large. But my talk is not really about women's studies, much as I believe in their scholarly, scientific, and human necessity. While I think that any Douglas student has everything to gain by investigating and enrolling in women's studies courses, I want to suggest that there is a more essential experience that you own yourselves, one which courses in women's studies can greatly enrich, but which finally depends on you in all your interactions with yourself and your world. This is the experience of taking responsibility towards yourselves. Our upbringing as women has so often told us that this should come second to our relationships and responsibilities to other people. We have been offered ethical models of the self-denying wife and mother, intellectual models of the brilliant but slapdash dilettante who never commits herself to anything the old way, or the intelligent woman who denies her intelligence in order to seem more feminine, or who sits in passive silence even when she disagrees inwardly with everything that is being said around her. Responsibility to yourself means refusing to let others do your thinking, talking, and naming for you. It means learning to respect and use your own brains and instincts. Hence, grappling with hard work. It means that you do not treat your body as a commodity with which to purchase superficial intimacy or economic security. For our bodies to be treated as objects, our minds are in mortal danger. It means insisting that those to whom you give your friendship and love are able to respect your mind. It means being able to say, with Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, "I have an inward treasure born with me, which can keep me alive if all the extraneous delights should be withheld or offered only at a price I cannot afford to give." Responsibility to yourself means that you don't fall for shallow and easy solutions, pre-digested books and ideas, weekend encounters guaranteed to change your life, taking gut courses instead of ones you know will challenge you, bluffing at school and life instead of doing solid work, marrying early as an escape from real decisions, getting pregnant as an evasion of already existing problems. It means that you refuse to sell your talents and aspirations short, simply to avoid conflict and confrontation. And this in turn means resisting the forces in society which say that women should be nice, play safe, have low professional expectations, drown in love and forget about work, live through others and stay in the places assigned to us. It means that we insist on a life of meaningful work, insist that work be as meaningful as love and friendship in our lives. It means, therefore, the courage to be different, not to be continuously available to others when we need time for ourselves and our work, to be able to demand of others, parents, friends, roommates, teachers, lovers, husbands, children, that they respect our sense of purpose and our integrity as persons. Women everywhere are finding the courage to do this more and more, and we are finding that courage both in our study of women in the past who possessed it and in each other as we look to other women for comradeship, community, and challenge. The difference between a life lived actively and a life of passive drifting and dispersal of energies is an immense difference. Once we begin to feel committed to our lives, responsible to ourselves, we can never again be satisfied with the old, passive way. Now comes the second part of the contract. I believe that in a women's college, you have the right to expect your faculty to take you seriously. The education of women has been a matter of debate for centuries and old negative attitudes about women's role. Women's ability to think and take leadership are still rife both in and outside the university. Many male professors still feel that teaching in a women's college is a second-rate career. Many tend to criticize their women students to treat them as sexual objects instead of demanding the best of their minds. At Yale, a legal suit has been brought against the university by a group of women students demanding a stated policy against sexual advances toward female students by male professors. Many teachers, both men and women, trained in the male-centered tradition are still handing the ideas and texts of that tradition onto students without teaching them to criticize its anti-women attitudes, its omission of women as part of the species. Too often, all of us fail to teach the most important thing, which is that clear thinking, active discussion, and excellent writing are all necessary for intellectual freedom, and that these require hard work, sometimes perhaps in discouragement with a culture which is both anti-intellectual and anti-woman. We may resign ourselves to low expectations for our students before we have given them half a chance to become more thoughtful, expansive human beings. We need to take to heart the words of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, a poet, a thinking woman, and a feminist, who wrote in 1845 of her impatience with studies which cultivate a passive recipiency in the mind, and asserted that women want to be made to think actively. Their apprehension is quicker than that of men, but their defect lies for the most part in the logical faculty and in the higher mental activities. Not that she implies a defect which can be remedied by intellectual training, not an inborn lack ability. I have said that the contract on the student's part involves that you demand to be taken seriously so that you can also go on taking yourself seriously. This means seeking out criticism, recognizing that the most affirming thing anyone can do for you is demand that you push yourself further, show you the range of what you can do. It means rejecting attitudes of take it easy, why be so serious, why worry, you will probably get married anyway. It means assuming your share of responsibility for what happens in the classroom, because that affects the quality of your daily life here. It means that the student sees herself engaged with her teachers in active, ongoing struggle for a real education. But for her to do this, her teachers must be committed to the belief that women's minds and experience are intrinsically valuable and indispensable to any civilization worthy the name, that there is no more exhilarating and intellectually fertile place in the academic world today than a women's college, if both students and teachers in large enough numbers are trying to fulfill this contract. The contract is really a pledge of mutual seriousness about women, about language, ideas, method, and values. It is our shared commitment towards a world in which the inborn potentialities of so many women's minds will no longer be wasted, reveled away, paralyzed, or denied. Exercise. Answer the following questions. In which collection was Claiming an Education included? The Dream of a Common Language, On Lies, Secrets and Silence, Leaflets, none of these. In which college did Adrienne Rich deliver the speech entitled Claiming an Education? Who was the author of Jane Eyre? Who stated that women's apprehension is quicker than that of men, but their defect lies for the most part in the logical faculty and in the higher mental activities? Answer the following questions in a sentence or two. How did Adrienne Rich plan to separate her remarks into two parts? Mention one of the devastating weaknesses of the university learning according to Rich. What is the difference between to claim an education and to receive an education? Why did women students and teachers demand for the introduction of women's studies courses? How does Adrienne Rich define taking responsibility towards yourselves from the feminist perspective? How did Elizabeth Barrett Browning express her impatience with studies? What, according to Rich, is the courage to be different? What, according to Rich, is the second part of the contract? What are the necessary ingredients of intellectual freedom? What does Adrienne Rich mean by students demand to be taken seriously? Answer the following questions in a paragraph. Adrienne Rich's prose style in Claiming an Education. The gendered bias in education, according to Adrienne Rich. How does Adrienne Rich elaborate the concept of responsibility to oneself? What should be the contract between the student and faculty? Answer the following questions in about 300 words. Claiming an Education is a critique of the present system of education from a women's perspective. Discuss. Critically evaluate Adrienne Rich's concept of education. Activity. Discuss how Adrienne Rich establishes the gender preference of various disciplines. Subject your discipline to a detailed analysis to find out the way the patriarchal is the normative order. For example, until the 19th century, the canon of English language consisted mostly of male authors. Read the essay, Talking Back, written by Bell Hooks alongside with Rich's Claiming an Education, and compare the way both the authors exposed the gender and racial discrimination that existed in the American society. Find out the ways in which women are segregated from men in India in the field of education. Glossary. Convocation, a large formal assembly of people. Ethical, moral. Contract, agreement. Intuitive, based on what one feels to be true even without conscious reasoning. Reclaimed, retrieved or regained. Receptacle, storehouse or container. Devastating, destroying or ruining. Curriculum. Subjects compressing a course of study in a school or college. Overwhelmingly, to a very great degree. Fragmented, broken off or separated. Exclusion, the process of denying someone access to a group, place, etc. Gradingly, in a resentful manner. Pouring, reading or studying. Inevitable, that cannot be avoided. Accusation, a charge that someone has done something wrong. Fadism, a tendency to look to a style, activity or interest for a very short span of time. Backlash, a strong negative reaction by a large number of people, especially to a social or political development. Douglas College, located in New Brunswick, New Jersey. It is part of the Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. Enrich, to improve the quality of something. Slapdash, done too hurriedly and carelessly. Dilettante, an amateur who often pretends to be very knowledgeable. Grappling, engaging in a close fight or struggle without weapons. Mortal, subject to death. Charlotte Bronte, a very popular Victorian novelist who lived in the 19th century. She was eldest of the Bronte sisters, whose novels are classics in world literature at present. Jane Eyre, a widely popular novel published in 1847, written by Charlotte Bronte under the pen name Currer-Bell. Extraneous, irrelevant to the subject discussed. Drifting, being carried by a current of air or water. Dispersal, the process of distributing things or people over a wide area. Eroticize, to make the arousal of sexual feelings. Yale, one of the oldest American universities situated in Connecticut, USA. Discouragement, a loss of confidence or enthusiasm. Anti-intellectual, hostile or indifferent to culture and intellectual reasoning. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, a British poet of the 19th century, very popular for her poems and feminist concerns. She was the wife of the great Victorian poet Robert Browning. Affirming, stating emphatically, indispensable, absolutely necessary. Exhilarating, thrilling, revealed away, disentangled or pulled away.
The Story of an Hour by Kate Chopin, introduction.
Kate Chopin is considered as one of the pioneers of feminist writing because of her unconventional lifestyle and novel ways of portraying women changing identity in 19th century American literature. In her characterization, she focused on the startling discrepancies between women and the men in their lives in unconventional ways. In other words, how women would act and feel their lives not dictated by the societal norms and male expectations was the familiar terrain of her long and short fictions. Kate Chopin was born in St. Louis of the United States on February 8, 1851, to a well-to-do couple, Thomas O'Flaherty, Eliza Ferris O'Flaherty. After her graduation, she married Oscar Chopin, son of Louisiana cotton planter. Before and after the marriage, she was an unconventional non-conformist who made friendship with the slaves of the family, smoked in public, and bathed open on the beaches. A financial crisis in 1879 and the untimely death of her husband in 1883 left her with six children in dire economic crisis, and to overcome the crisis, she decided to take up the writing professionally. She began her career with short fictions and essays, and in 1890, At Fault, her first novel was published. In The Awakening, published in 1899, Chopin controversially anticipates some of the major concerns of feminist movement. The examination of unhappy marriages, the question of divorce in rational, unemotional manner, and the theme of love outside marriages, concerns ahead of times, form some of the major themes of her novel. The hostile criticism with which the novels were received had a shocking effect on Chopin, as her publishers cancelled her future contract. She lived only 5 more years and died of cerebral hemorrhage on August 22, 1904. However, it was posthumously that she came to be regarded as an important writer and a champion of rights of women. Besides the two novels, Chopin authored about 100 short stories and some essays. Most of them were about Creole society of the South of America. She is one of the pioneers of woman writing in America. Critics at present appreciate her skill and artistry, particularly her striking use of psychological realism, symbolical imaginary, and sensuous themes. The feminist movement lauds Chopin's portrayal of character like Edna Pontellier in The Awakening, and the critical derogation on the restraints tradition placed on women. The Story of an Hour, originally published in Vogue on 6 December 1894, as The Dream of an Hour, is a brilliant exploration of concept of marriage from a feminist perspective as a site of confinement. Through the universal and the timeless theme, the story also seeks an understanding of the meaning of gender roles and a proper definition of what it means to be free and happy. The startling anticlimax with which the story is concluded also throws light on the meaning of life and death. Louis' thoughts, like Edna's action in The Awakening, reflects the moods and emotions felt by many women who sought personal freedom. Knowing that Mrs. Mallard was afflicted with a heart trouble, great care was taken to break to her as gently as possible the news of her husband's death. It was her sister, Josephine, who told her in a broken sentence, veiled hints that relieved in half concealing. Her husband's friend, Richards, was there too, near her. It was he who had been in the newspaper office when intelligence of the railway road disaster was received, with Bentley Mallard's name leading the list of killed. He had only taken the time to assure himself of its truth by the second telegram, and had hastened to forestall by less careful, less tender friend in bearing the sad message. She did not hear the story as many women have heard the same, with a paralyzed inability to accept its significance. She wept at once, with a sudden wild abandonment, in her sister's arms. When the storm of grief had spent itself, she went away to her room alone. She would have no one follow her. There stood, facing the open window, a comfortable, roomy armchair. Into this she sank, pressed down by the physical exhaustion that hunted her body and seemed to reach into her soul. She could see, in the open square before her house, the top of trees that were all aquare with a new spring life. The delicious breath of rain was in the air. In the street below, a peddler was crying in vase. The notes of distant song which someone was singing reached her faintly, and countless sparrows were twittering in the eaves. There were patches of blue sky showing here and there. The clouds that had met the paled one above the other in the west facing her window. She sat with her head thrown back upon the cushion of the chair, quite motionless except when a sob came up into her throat and shook her. As a child who has cried itself to sleep continues to sob in its dreams. She was young, with a fair, clean face, whose lines bespoke repression and even a certain strength. But now there was a dull stare in her eyes, whose gaze was fixed away off yonder on one of those patches of the blue sky. It was a glance of reflection, but rather indicate a suspension of intelligent thought. There was something coming to her, and she was waiting for it, fearfully. What was it? She did not know. It was too subtle and elusive to name. But she felt it, creeping out of the sky, reaching towards her through the sounds, the scents, the color that filled the air. Now her bosom rose and fell tumultuously. She was beginning to recognize this thing that was approaching to possess her, and she was striving to beat it back with her will as powerless as her two white, slender hands would have been. When she abandoned herself, a little whispered word escaped her slightly parted lips. She said it over and over under her breath. Free, free, free. The vacant stare and the look of the terror that had followed it went from her eyes. They stayed knee and bright. Her pulses beat fast, and coursing blood warmed and relaxed every inch of her body. She did not stop to ask if it were or were not a monstrous joy that held her. A clear and exalted perception enabled her to dismiss the suggestion of the travel. She knew she would weep again when she saw the kind, tender hands folded in death, the face that had never looked same with love upon her, fixed and grey and dead. But she saw beyond that bitter moment a long procession of years to come that would belong to her absolutely. And she opened and spread her arms out to them in welcome. There would be no one to leave her during those coming years. She would live for herself. There would be no powerful will bending hers in the blind persistence with which men and women believe they have a right to impose a private will upon our fellow creature. A kind intention or a cruel intention make the act seem no less a crime as she looked upon it that brief moment of illumination. And yet she had loved him sometimes, often had not. What did it matter? What could love, the unsolved mystery, count for in a face of this possession of self-astration which she suddenly recognized as the strongest impulse of her being? Free body and soul free, she kept whispering. Josephine was kneeling before the closed door with her lips to the keyhole, imploring for admission. Louis, open the door, I beg. Open the door. You will make yourself ill. What are you doing, Louis? For heaven's sake, open the door. Go away. I am not making myself ill. No, she was drinking in a very elixir of life through that open window. Her fancy was running riot along those days ahead of her. Spring days and summer days and all sorts of day that would be her own. She birthed a quick prayer that light might be long. It was only yesterday she had thought with a shudder that life might be long. She arose at the length and opened the door to her sister's importunities. There was a feverish triumph in her eyes, and she carried herself unwittingly like a goddess of victory. She clasped her sister's waist, and together they descended the stairs. Richard stood waiting for them at the bottom. Someone was opening the front door with a latchkey. It was Bentley Mallard who entered, a little travel-stained, composedly carrying his grip sack and umbrella. He had been far from the scene of accident and did not even know there had been one. He stood amazed at Josephine's piercing cry, at Richard's quick motion of screen him from the view of his wife. But Richard was too late. When the doctor came, they said she had died of heart disease, of joy that kills. Veiled suggestion than statement. Hastened, was quick to do something. First of all, to prevent abandonment, yielding without restraint or moderation. Pressed down, depressed, acquire, vibrant. Peddler, a person who goes from place to sell goods. Bespoke, spoke about. Unwittingly, unintentionally. Glass, grabs tightly with one's hand. Exercises, choose the right answer from the following. First question, in which magazine was The Story of an Hour originally published? Vogue, The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Newsweek. Second question, who told Mrs. Mallard of her husband's death in veiled hints? Third question, what was the original title of The Story of an Hour? Fourth question, who was Mrs. Richards? Answer the following questions in sentence or two. First question, why was great care taken in breaking the news of her husband to Mrs. Mallard? Second question, what was Mrs. Mallard's immediate reaction when she heard the news of her husband's death? Third question, how was the outside world described after Mrs. Mallard heard the news of her husband's death? Fourth question, comment on the symbol of the open window. Fifth one, which were the words whispered by her when she sat herself? Sixth one, how did Bentley Richard escape the railroad accident? Seventh one, what is the climax of The Story of an Hour? Eighth one, explain, she had died of heart disease. of joy that kills. Answer the following questions in a paragraph. First question, the treatment of the gender in The Story of an Hour. Second question, Chopin's treatment of marriage and family. Third question, the character of Louis Malard. Fourth question, the thoughts that flashed through Mrs. Malard's mind after realizing her husband's death. Fifth question, comment on the climax of The Story of an Hour. Answer the following questions in about 300 words. First one, Kate Chopin, The Story of an Hour, is an attempt to highlight the inherent oppressiveness of marriage. Discuss. Second one, Kate Chopin, The Story of an Hour, deals with the forbidden joy of independence. Elucidate. Activity. First one, do you think Mr. Malard's grieving process will be similar to Mrs. Malard? If yes, find reason. If no, find reason. In this contest, discuss how freedom and conformity are subjective, even though people may not demonstrate it. Second one, compare the contrast. The Story of an Hour with a film like The Color of Purple, English Winglish, and The Gone Girl. Arrange a discussion on the gender imbalance that exists in our society.
What it's like to be transgender. Lee Mokop. Lerato Lee Mokop was born in 1996 in Cape Town, South Africa. Mokop is an award-winning slam poet and the founder of Vocal Revolutionaries, a volunteer-run literary organization focused on empowering the youth of South Africa to find their voice through art. The organization offers free workshops, motivational talks, seasonal slams, national or local performances, and mentoring. In 2013, Mokop South African Slam Poetry Team, which was also named Vocal Revolutionaries, made it to the final stage of the Brave New Voice Global Poetry Competition, an event of American Poetry Slam, which is begun in 1998 in Chicago. The first team from the African continent to compete, they came second among the 55 teams in the world that were shortlisted. In 2015, Lee came out as a transgender male. Now, Mokop works as a teaching artist across the United States. Lee Mokop has been a TED Fellow since 2015, being a performer who wrote several plays, has made a few short films with the help of the media company Soul Pancake at the YouTube Space Studio. The 21-year-old writer is a political activist who criticizes the lack of freedom of expression in South Africa and the extreme right-wing politics of Donald Trump, the President of the United States, in a poem titled The Not Yet Burning Country. What It's Like to Be Transgender is a soul bearing poem about what it feels like to be a transgender in a highly gendered culture. It powerfully addresses the gender identity issues in the context of transphobia and the increased suicide rates among the transgender people. In the autobiographical poem about the history of one's gender expression, Mokop describes how he came out as a transgender. I was the mystery of an anatomy, a question asked but not answered, tightroping between awkward boy and apologetic girl. And when I turned 11, the boy face wasn't deemed cute anymore. Being a thoughtful description on bodies and the meanings poured into them. The poem captures the identity crisis imposed on the transgender people every now and then by the mainstream culture. Towards the end of the gripping exploration of identity and transition, the poet turns into a pessimistic mood, having recognized one's non-acceptance in a world where religions preach universal love.
Poem, What It's Like to Be Transgender. The first time I uttered a prayer was in a glass-stained cathedral. I was kneeling long after the congregation was on its feet, dipped both hands into holy water, traced the Trinity across my chest, my tiny body drooping like a question mark. All over the wooden pew, I asked Jesus to fix me, and when he did not answer, I befriended silence in the hopes that my sin would burn and salve my mouth would dissolve like sugar on tongue. But shame lingered as an aftertaste, and in an attempt to reintroduce me to sanctity, my mother told me of the miracle I was, said I could grow up to be anything I want. I decided to be a boy. It was cute. I had snapback, toothless grin. I used skinned knees as street cred, played hide and seek with what was left of my goal. I was it. The winner to a game the other kids couldn't play. I was the mystery of an anatomy, a question asked but not answered. Tightroping between awkward boy and apologetic girl. And when I turned tall, the boy face wasn't deemed cute anymore. It was met with nostalgic aunts who missed seeing my knees in the shadow of skirts, who reminded me that my kind of attitude would never bring a husband home, that I exist for heterosexual marriage and childbearing, and I swallowed their insult along with their slurs. Naturally, I did not come out of the closet. The kids at my school opened it without my permission, called me my name I did not recognize, said lesbian. But I was more boy than girl, more Ken than Barbie. It had nothing to do with hating my body. I just loved it enough to let it go. I treat it like a house. And when your house is falling apart, you do not evacuate. You make it comfortable enough to house all your insides. You make it pretty enough to invite guests over. You make the floorboard strong enough to stand on. My mother fears I have named myself after fading things as she counts the echoes left behind by Mia Hall, Leela Alcorn, Blake Brockington. She fears that I will die without a whisper, that I will turn into what a shame conversation at the bus stop. She claims I have turned myself into She claims I have turned myself into a mausoleum, that I am walking casket. News headlines have turned my identity into spectacle. Bruce Jenner on everyone's lips. While the brutality of living in this body becomes an asterisk at the bottom of the equality pages, no one ever thinks of us as human because we are more ghosts than flesh, because people fear that my gender expression is a trick, that it exists to be perverse, that it ensnares them without their consent, that my body is a feast for their eyes and hands, and once they have fed off my cure, they will regurgitate all the parts they did not like. They will put me back into the closet, hang me with all other skeletons. I will be the best attraction. Can you see how easy it is to talk people into coffins, to misspell their names on gravestones, and people still wonder why there are boys rotting. They go away in high school hallways. They are afraid of becoming another hashtag in a second, afraid of classroom discussions becoming like Judgment Day, and now oncoming traffic is embracing more transgender children than parents. I wonder how long it will be before the trans suicide norms start to feel redundant, before we realize that our bodies become lessons about sin way before we learn how to love them. Like God didn't save all this breath and mercy. Like my blood is not the wine that washed over Jesus' feet. My prayers are now getting stuck in my throat. Maybe I am finally fixed. Maybe I just don't care. Maybe God finally listened to my prayers. Thank you.
Glossary. Congregation. A group of people assembled for religious worship. Holy water. Water blessed by a priest and used in religious ceremonies. It also refers to the consecrated water used in the ceremony of baptism. Drooping, bending or hanging downwards limply. Pew, a compartment in the auditorium of a church providing seats for the several persons. To fix me, to assign a specific gender role. Lingered, stayed in a place longer than usual or expected because of the reluctance to leave. Snapback, a sudden rebound or change in direction. Street cred, informal expression for street credibility. It means acceptability among fashionable young urban people. Mystery of an anatomy, the expression stands for the absence of fixed gender identity of a person, that is the condition of being neither a male nor a female. Tightropping, performing on a tightrope. Here it indicates the identity crisis of a child whose gender is not fixed, or the situation of being a boy and a girl at the same time. Slur, an insinuation or allegation about someone that is likely to insult them or damage their reputation. Come out of the closet, to publicly announce a preference on has kept hidden, especially one sexual preference. The word is noted here for the pun, the literal closed room, and the figural declaration of identity. Lesbian, a homosexual woman, often a woman with confusion in one's gender identities, is called a lesbian in a derogatory way. The instance narrated here has autobiographical resonances, as it described the phase in which Lee Mokobe was a victim of apartheid and transphobia in the sans Sosie Girls High School, Newlands, Cape Town. Ken and Barbie dolls stand up for the boy and the girl respectively. Kenneth Carson and Barbara Millicent Roberts are the respective full names of these fictional characters of American popular culture. As per the cartoons, Ken is Barbie's boyfriend. Floorboard, a long plank making a part of a wooden floor in a building. Mia Hall, a 27-year-old transgender woman who was shot dead by police in Baltimore, USA on 30 March 2015 for taking a wrong turn on the road.
The police version claimed that she had a history of robbery and prostitution, but the transgender community describes the incident as an example of transphobia. Leila Alcon, an American transgender girl who committed suicide at the age of 17 to stop discrimination and abuse after being struck by a semi-trailer, Ohio, USA. In her suicide note, she cited loneliness and alienation alongside with the parental neglect as the key reasons to end her life. Blake Brockington, an American transgender man who committed suicide after being struck by several workers in Charlotte, North Carolina, USA on 23 March 2015 before turning 19. He was the first openly transgender high school homecoming king of the state. Mausoleum, Magnificent Tomb. It is a stately, impressive building in which bodies of dead people are buried. Casket, a coffin or a box in which the body of a dead person is buried. Bruce Jenner, William Bruce Jenner, year 1949. He was an American television personality and Olympic gold medal winning athlete in the decathlon in the 1976 Montreal Olympic. Equality pages, the pages of the newspapers and magazines which often discuss gender and sexual equality, to be perverse, to behave in a way that is unreasonable or unacceptable to others. Being a transgender, a bisexual, a lesbian or a gay was considered as a case of perversion by most conservatives, ensnares, traps or catches somebody in a snare, feast for their eyes, an expression standing for using the strange body of the transgender for visual and sensory pleasures. It shows the attitude of the mainstream society towards the sexual and gender minorities. Queer, an umbrella term to designate sexual and gender minorities who are not heterosexual or not cisgender. It was once a derogatory term, but now used as political defense against abuse. Regurgitate, to bring back already swallowed food back up through one's throat and out the mouth. Hang, other skeletons, to put people back into the closet. It refers to the common experience of placing the transgenders into the closet to reform them. Hashtag, a word or phrase preceded by a hash sign, used on social media, websites and applications to identify messages on a particular topic. Judgment Day. According to Christianity, the day the world ends and everyone is required to stand up for the final verdict. Redundant, excess or superfluous. Wash Jesus' feet. A sinful woman in the town washed Jesus' feet at the residence of a rich Pharisee. Stuck in my throat. The condition of being unable to say something due to one's emotional state. First exercise. Answer the following questions. First question. Where did the speaker make a prayer for the first time? Second question. Identify the figure of each speech. My tiny body drooping like a question mark all over the wooden pew. A. Simile. B. Metaphor. C. Metonymy. D. Personification. Third question. I treat it like a house. What? Fourth question. Who is the trans woman shot dead by the police in Baltimore referred to in the poem? Fifth question. Who is the Olympic gold winning decathlete mentioned in what it's like to be transgender. Third exercise, answer the following questions in a sentence or two. First question, what did the speaker ask Jesus in the first prayer? First question, what did the speaker ask Jesus in the first prayer? Second question, explain, but shame lingered as an aftertaste. Third question, what did the mother do to reintroduce the speaker to sanctity? Fourth question, how did the speaker describe the face? I decided to be a boy. Fifth question, explain, I was the mystery of an anatomy. Sixth question, how did the narrator observe the boyhood face at the age of 12? Seventh question, what did the nostalgic aunts remind the speaker at the age of 12? Eighth question, how was the speaker called a lesbian? Ninth question, what is meant by the expression I was more Ken than Barbie? Tenth question, she, in bracket my mother, fears that I will die without a whisper. Why? 11th question, who was Mia Hart? 12th question, who was Leela Alcorn? 13th question, who was Blake Brockington? 14th question, why does no one ever think of transgender as human? 15th question, explain, now oncoming traffic is embracing more transgender children than parents. 16th question, my prayers are now getting stuck in my throat. Why did the speaker fear so? Third exercise, answer the following questions in a paragraph. First question, comment on the poetic style in What It's Like to Be Transgender. Second question, the boyhood phase in What It's Like to Be Transgender. Third question, briefly describes the alienation of the transgender in relation to What It's Like to Be Transgender. Fourth question, the pessimism in What It's Like to Be Transgender. Fifth question, comment on the ending of Lee Mokobe's poem. Fourth exercise, answer the following questions in about 300 words. First question, What It's Like to Be Transgender is a documentation of the identity crisis and the denial of the basic human rights of the transgender discussed. Second question, how does Lee Mokobe convey the horror of being a transgender in What It's Like to Be Transgender? Activity 1, compare What It's Like to Be Transgender with other significant transgender poems. For instance, June Jordan's A Poem About My Rights, Joanna Hoffman's Pride, and Audre Lorde's Movement Song can be read and analyzed in the context of gender issues and identity crisis. Arrange a discussion in the classroom about the queer identities and their rights. Second question, sexual minorities have started to come out of the closet. Still, their human rights are violated throughout the globe. The Danish Girl, directed by Tom Hooper, based on David Eberskopf's novel, is a beautifully narrated humanistic account of the identity crisis of the people trapped in the wrong body. On the basis of the film, a discussion can be arranged about the empathetic attitude the society should have towards the sexual minorities and the transgenders.